you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I'm Dan Peterson for petitioner appellant Keith Baranski. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. As the court knows, under Brady and Giglio, the prosecution is required to turn over all evidence to the defendant that's either exculpatory or might affect the credibility of prosecution witnesses. In this case, the government had in its possession several categories of information that would have severely undermined the credibility of the prosecution's star witness, James Carmi, and that information was withheld from Mr. Baranski. Maybe even more importantly in this case, the prosecution affirmatively represented for all of those categories of evidence that all impeachment evidence had already been turned over to counsel when it had not.
Is the government obligated to discover and turn over material that's in the possession of the Bureau of Prisons?
I think it would be if there was a request for that. And as it turns out, some of the briefing it's cleared up in our reply brief here, Your Honor. apparently no one noticed it. I didn't. That's why I brought it up in the reply. There was some question as to whether or not the defense had access to the health records of Mr. Carmi. Mm-hmm. And what I didn't know, I think we could not get them because if we subpoenaed it, it had to go back through the prosecutor's office, who had already refused to turn them over to us. But in any event, it turns out that in a hearing before Magistrate Judge Medler, and it was way at the end of the hearing, which I think kind of out of order why no one noticed, Mr. Martin represented that he had been in touch with the Bureau of Prisons up in Minnesota, and that they had furnished him the medical records, and he'd been through them, and that there was he's turned over everything that was of impeachment value in the case. So we have a representation that he turned over everything that was of value as far as the medical records is concerned. On the record, it's quoted in our reply brief. Later on, it turns out, almost 10 years afterwards, it turns out that there were more records that had not been turned over. I'd like to talk principally, to begin with, about the Rule 35 issue. And I think the key error in the memorandum opinion in this case is that it found that, quote, the government did not promise Carmi a further reduction in his sentence under Rule 35 in return for his testimony at Mr. Baranski's trial. But there was clearly a discussion of that at the sentencing hearing, and there was a sidebar that went on off the record first between counsel and Judge Weber. Then they went back on the record, and Judge Weber very clearly made a distinction between a 5K1.1 motion, for which he reduced his Carmi sentence to 42 months, and then basically went on to say after that, in addition, he said, it's been represented to me, depending upon certain circumstances that happen hereafter, which you and counsel can discuss, that there's a likelihood that a further reduction at some time in the future, depending upon your continued cooperation, may occur. And the Assistant U.S. Attorney, Mr. Paling, was present for those statements and acknowledged them on the record. Then we've included, and some of it's in the addendum to our brief, easily available there, correspondence between Mr. Carmi and his attorneys, Rogers and Rosenblum, expressly elaborating that this was a Rule 35 motion and referencing further follow-up conversations they had with Mr. Paling over, I think it went through the spring of the following year. This was a sentencing hearing was in November of 2001, and then these discussions went on up through 2002.
What, can you help me a little bit with a timeline? I'm interested in Judge Weber's statement at sentencing she mm-hmm. just talked about.
Yes.
Help me with a timeline. At what point in the narrative of your case did this occur?
Okay. It occurred on November 8th, 2001.
Okay, and help me with how that fits in with the principal events that you're relying on.
Sure. Mr. Carmi was arrested in the fall of 2000, I believe. Mr. Baranski then started to become entangled, if you will. It had kind of an unusual beginning with the government in 2001. His trial was started November 12th of 2002. So it's about a one-year period between the sentencing hearing and when Mr. Baranski's trial was, if that helps a little bit.
Thank you.
Okay. And I do want to mention one thing.
Counsel, the briefs ignore what seems to me to be a significant question, is why AEDPA standards should not apply to this quorum nobis motion.
Why which standards?
AEDPA's successive habeas standards.
I don't think there's been any abuse of the writ here, if that's your question.
No. You ignored the requirements for successive. If this were a habeas petition, it'd be successive, right?
Yes.
So it would not have. It would have been. There would have been no jurisdiction in the district court.
Well, this is a petition for quorum nobis, and it's one where the.
The quorum nobis does not apply where there's an alternative remedy. The Donito case in many.
There was no alternative remedy here, Your Honor, the reason for
because,
that is.
Sorry, because.
The reason there's no other remedy is because none of these facts became known. It came out in a big cascade beginning in 2010 when the trial was actually took place.
Fine. The habeas takes that into account.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is we had no factual basis for this because it had been essentially covered up or not disclosed to Mr. Baranski or his counsel. It did come out in 2010, and by that point
in
time...
Have you researched my question?
I have not.
Well, Brown in the Fourth Circuit and Baptiste in the Third Circuit say that quorum nobis cannot be used to end around the habeas restrictions in AEDPA.
Okay. If you'd like, I can submit a supplemental memorandum on that.
I've already researched it. I'm surprised no one, frankly, has thought of it, since there's also contrary authority in the Ninth Circuit. So we've got at least three circuits that have spoken on this, and complete silence in this case. I think it's a very serious issue.
All right.
Counsel, what about wasn't this witness questioned about possible Rule 35 relief?
Yes, Mr. Carmi. He was asked whether that was... whether he'd been offered anything. I think that it was phrased in terms of whether he was expecting a further reduction in his sentence. And he basically said, here's the quote, "And you wanted another, you expected you were going to get another deal for actually testifying, didn't you?" And he answered, "I never said that, and I never expected it. I've never been promised anything, and as a matter of fact, I've never asked for anything except for a transfer to another facility." In point of fact, he was clearly expecting it, as correspondence indicates, with his counsel, and he was utterly flabbergasted, shocked beyond belief when he didn't get it in December of 2002, right after his trial. So, I think this was a completely false statement by Mr. Carmi.
What about the private investigator? Didn't the private investigator uncover at least some indicators of along these lines?
What the private Carmi told the private investigator that he might ask for a Rule 35 in the future. But he didn't say anything about already having been offered one or expecting one. I mean, it was the barest possibility, and it was nothing on which We could have based an appeal or a post-conviction motion or anything of that nature.
So why was the witness asked about it? If there was no information there to indicate that was.
He was asked about it because the investigator uncovered this, you know, or got that statement from Mr. Carmi, and so Mr. Gardner, the trial counsel, asked him about it, and Carmi flatly denied it. And Carmi was there at the sentencing hearing, and as well as his attorneys and Mr. Paling, and it was quite clear that an additional reduction was being offered in addition to the 5K1.1 motion.
So you think that because the witness denied it, even though you had a reason to ask, because the witness denied it, that there was inadequate notice or indication of this possible claim that it could have been brought up earlier?
Inadequate proof, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. There was nothing to put his hands on. And counsel for Mr. Baranski had asked Mr. Martin whether there was a Rule 35 motion being considered. And Mr. Martin said no. He emphatically denied it. And, in fact, he denies it to this day, as I understand it. And says that there never was a, quote, promise of a Rule 35. And I'd like to address that a little bit, too, because I don't think it has to be a promise. And if you read the memorandum opinion from below, the trial court, and this is following the lead of the prosecution in this case at the evidentiary hearing and so forth, they always say that there was no, quote, promise. Well, no, there wasn't a promise per se. There was a likelihood is the way that Judge Weber described it. These things by their nature are never likely to be a promise per se because it depends upon the performance of the witness at a later time, which is exactly what Judge Weber said, based upon your continuing cooperation.
Is that the evidence, the Judge Weber's statement in the transcript from 2001?
Yes. And the question is it in evidence?
No. Is that the sum total of the basis for this claim that Judge Weber made this statement of possibility of additional consideration if he continued to cooperate back in 2001?
It's the claim itself, if I may say so. I mean, he stated it in open court. It was transcribed by the court reporter. And then there is a whole train of correspondence after that and events that took place that indicate that Mr. Carmi definitely believed that he had an offer, he would call it sometimes a promise, of a further reduction. I see that my time is up, and I'll return in a few minutes. Thank you so much.
Mr. Drake?
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. In order for the appellant to succeed in this proceeding, Your Honors, this court would have to find that the district court clearly erred in its findings of fact, of which it made over 177 findings in its memorandum and order, which is 72 pages long, or that the district court committed legal error, but not just any legal error. It would have to be legal error that rises to the extraordinary level that is reserved for only the rarest of cases, those in which the most fundamental errors of character occur, ones in which the integrity of the proceedings below are compromised. That is not the case here, Your Honors. The parties here are in general agreement as to the application of the law. In other words, there's no disagreement that the court chose the correct law and applied it correctly, at least as it relates to the quorum nobis proceeding. In terms of the
counsel, did the government argue to the district court my AEDPA point?
No, Your Honor. I heard your questions earlier. That was not argued before the district court, other than in the context of the abuse of the writ proceeding.
Well, if correct, it would have deprived the court of jurisdiction. So we can consider it sua sponte, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that this court could do that. I think that while I'm unfamiliar with the case that you referred to, Your Honor, I do believe that your argument or that issue at least dovetails into our argument, the government's argument, in terms of the abuse of the writ. And let me be clear on that. From day one, 15 years ago, when this case originally started, the petitioner or the appellant has known all of the information that is in the that is in his pleading. In other words, he may not have had the specific document, but he's known all of the information and the substance of that information. In fact, he's litigated it on numerous occasions before the magistrate court, before the district court, and before this body for years. And in terms of the specific documents, even though he didn't have all of the specific documents, he knew where they were, he knew how to get them, and he chose not to. And I think that that's the substance of our argument in terms of the abuse of the writ, that either it's been litigated by the appellant in prior proceedings, or that he knew about it and he chose not to litigate it when he had an opportunity to do so. Concerning the findings of fact, Your Honors, the appellant disagrees with some of the 177 facts that were found by the district court. He has not demonstrated, however, that those findings are clearly erroneous. He doesn't argue that the court, the district court, at least, in the evidentiary hearing, misunderstood the facts. He doesn't argue that the court failed to consider certain facts. Instead, he argues that the district court should have found those facts differently. And that's not a that does not meet the clearly erroneous standard and the high burden that he has to meet. Furthermore, what's important here, Your Honors, is that the district court listened to the witnesses. It assessed their credibility. AUSA Paling, who was the prosecutor who handled Mr. Carmi's case initially, testified at the evidentiary hearing. United States Attorney Martin, who was the lead prosecutor for Mr. Baranski, the appellant's criminal case, testified at the hearing. Mr. Carmi himself testified at the hearing. After all of that testimony and receiving all of the evidence, the district court made its conclusions based on the credibility of those witnesses. And the key finding that the district court made, as it relates to this Rule 35 issue, which I'd like to talk about in just a second here, is that there was no promise and there was no offer. And I respectfully disagree with my opposing counsel about the word promise and the word expectation. Mr. Carmi testified at the trial that he was not promised a Rule 35 and that he never expected one. So we're not just dealing with the word promise. He had no expectation. And the district court found that testimony compelling, and it found it credible, and it found that Mr. Carmi did not perjure himself when he testified that way.
Before you move on, counsel, on the matter of standard of review, the district court concluded that the records of which the petitioner is complaining wouldn't have opened a new avenue of impeachment anyway. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, it absolutely is.
Is that a conclusion of law or conclusion of fact or what?
I think...
Finding of fact, I mean, or what?
Well, I think that whether or not it would have opened new avenues of impeachment is a question of fact, Your Honor, because in this case, the district court in holding the evidentiary hearing was also the court that handled the underlying criminal trial. And so that court was able to see the proceedings, the criminal trial proceedings, firsthand. It knew what the impeachment was at the criminal trial, and it then again heard the evidence at the evidentiary hearing.
I guess maybe the meaning of the phrase new avenue is really a legal question, though, isn't it? And then you look at the facts to see whether this legal principle has been undermined or not.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. Let me clarify my point. In other words, the district court knew what the avenues of impeachment were at the criminal trial.
Right.
So that is a finding of fact that should be reviewed for clearly on a clearly erroneous standard. The effect that impeachment might have had may be certainly a mixed question that this court could review. And let's be clear. When Mr. Carmi testified at the criminal trial, he was extensively examined about whether or not he believed or expected that a Rule 35 promise would be made. He was extensively, in fact, not only was he cross-examined about it, and that matter was put before the jury, but the appellant was able to put on extrinsic evidence of whether or not he believed the Rule 35 promise had been made. So the district court, in evaluating whether or not any of this material would have opened up new lines of impeachment, was able to assess what would have been the value had they have had the transcript or any of these other documents that the appellant believes he should have been entitled to have.
Yeah, I was speaking mainly to the documents that would go to impeachment.
Yes, Your Honor. And let me talk about it.
If you want to move on from that, that's fine. You mentioned the Rule 35. What explain to me why Judge Weber's statements should be given a lot of weight here.
Certainly, Your Honor. First, James Carmi testified, and the district court made a finding of fact that he didn't hear Judge Weber's comments. Those happened. He did not hear Judge Weber's comments, so he could not have been laboring under the expectation that he was going to get a Rule 35 because of those comments. He didn't hear them. And the district court made that very specific finding of fact. Secondly, the district court found that Judge Weber's comments didn't refer to a Rule 35 promise. I agree with counsel that there was commentary about the likelihood of a potential sentencing reduction from some unknown basis or unknown reason at some indefinite time in the future. They were very conditional. Furthermore,
what did they refer to?
Well, in any case, Judge, if a defendant were to come up with some sort of new information or some new revelatory point, they could always come back and approach the government and say, "Government, we've learned of something. Would you consider?"
What are you talking about? Rule 35 or what?
It would depend on when it would happen in the proceedings. But yes, Your Honor, that would be a possibility.
Well, I mean, help me with this. It used to be anyway that a Rule 35 motion couldn't be made after a year after judgment, I guess it was, or some event. I forget.
That is correct, Your Honor. At the time this proceeding took place, the rule was that the Rule 35 had to be filed within 1 year, and the district court found that as a finding of fact.
Yeah.
And it cited that as one of the eight reasons that it gave for why no Rule 35 promise or expectation or offer had been made, among the other multitude of reasons why the court found, based on the credibility of the witnesses, it didn't happen. So in other words, to your question, when Judge Weber was talking at sidebar with counsel, that discussion was no different than any discussion, that there's always a possibility that somebody could come forward. But let me make a further point about Judge Weber's comments in the sentencing proceeding. The appellant asked to have the sentencing transcript turned over, asked in discovery and before the magistrate court for the government to disclose it. The district court found, and it is the case, that the government didn't have the sentencing transcript. Certainly we were aware of the information because we were deemed to be aware of it, but we didn't have it. So instead, what James Martin, the U.S. attorney at the time and who handled the criminal case, did is he told the appellant where to go to get it. He said, "I don't have the sentencing transcript. You can go and get it from the court reporter." In other words, there was parity between the parties. The government had no greater access to the sentencing transcript than the defendant did at the time. He knew where to get it, how to get it. He could have filed a motion to unseal it just like the government did.
Found as a fact it was not in their possession?
Yes, there was a finding of fact that the government didn't possess it. So, in other words...
So, even so, it doesn't really matter because they could have... This was information that was within their control.
It was information that was...
It was within their control to discover.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. It was information that they had access to. Certainly, it was under seal, but they could have done just what the government did after the trial, which is file the motion to unseal and go get it. And that's the salient point that I'm trying to make in our brief, Your Honors, is that and it also goes to the abuse of the writ. The appellant here had access to all of the information. So when you referred to other documents earlier, Judge Arnold, that could have led to new lines of impeachment, say whether that's Bureau of Prison Records, things like that, those were litigated. Those were brought before the magistrate court. So the appellant knew about them. For instance, he could have subpoenaed the Bureau of Prisons, and I respectfully disagree with counsel. Sure, you would have to go through some procedures to get them, whether that's TUI regulations or other procedures, but there are avenues that you can go and get the information. The appellant could have done that, but chose not to. The documents that he's claiming were suppressed were not suppressed under the standards of Brady because they knew of the existence of the information. They cross-examined Mr. Carmi about his memory loss, about brain damage, about any cooperation he had. All of those matters were before the jury, Your Honor. And to the extent that they could have gotten additional documents, they could have subpoenaed them. They could have subpoenaed witnesses from the Bureau of Prisons. They could have gone through any procedures to call those people before the tribunal. They chose not to do that.
It's not all quite clear. It would have been helpful anyway. Indeed, the district court said it wouldn't.
The district court not only found that it wouldn't be helpful, Your Honor, they said that it would be cumulative. All of those issues were before the jury.
That's what I mean.
Those were all issues before the jury at the time.
Could have been harmful.
It could have been
a lingering aspect of it.
It could have been, and ironically, Mr. Carney was cross-examined about those various instances. I'm sorry, Judge Logan, did you have a question?
No.
Okay.
Now, Mr. Baranski has already served his sentence.
Mr. Baranski had served his has already served his sentence, yes.
And his term of supervised release.
That was term that was over, yes.
So how does that play into all of this? Is that something what adverse consequences is he facing that warrant this kind of relief?
Well, Mr. Baranski was convicted for trying to fill out false forms to import hundreds, if not thousands, of automatic weapons. He wants his conviction expunged so that he can go back into the firearms dealing business. That's part of the record. He's saying that he is laboring from an adverse consequence of having a felony conviction which prohibits him from importing firearms, which is the very thing that he was convicted of for trying to import falsely in the beginning. The district court did find that he was suffering from adverse consequences, Your Honor, and the government doesn't dispute that finding.
Do we have a case on that issue?
On the adverse consequence issue? There are some that were cited in the briefs that the parties filed before the district court about whether or not the mere stain of a felony conviction can rise to the level of an adverse consequence, and courts disagree on that subject, Your Honor.
But do we have a case from the Eighth Circuit on that point?
Not that I'm aware of from the Eighth Circuit, Your Honor. There are some that say it has to be more than just the stain of a felony conviction, or the lack of the right to be able to vote. But Mr. Baranski is, at the time at least, during the proceedings leading up to the evidentiary hearing, was unemployed. He wasn't claiming that he couldn't find a job or anything like that.
The government's not standing and fighting on that.
No, Your Honor.
On that
we would agree with the district court's finding of fact that he is suffering from an adverse consequence. Although this court could certainly, because it's de novo review, find that just the felony conviction is not sufficient. But we're not disputing that, Your Honor. Unless there are other questions, I'd like to conclude by saying that, going back to my original starting point, which is that the government believes that this is an abuse of the writ because all of these matters have been previously litigated on numerous occasions. Remember that quorum nobis is an extremely rare remedy, reserved for the rarest of cases. And based on my research, I am unaware of the Eighth Circuit ever granting quorum nobis, a writ of quorum nobis.
Let me ask you a question about that.
Yes, sir.
There's a lot of apocalyptic talk about how this is something that hardly ever happens, and indeed there's a First Circuit case in which I think Judge Selya compares quorum nobis to a Hail Mary in a football game. But I wonder, is that really about the standard of review, or is that just about just a statement about how, as a factual matter, quorum nobis hardly ever works because, for one thing, the sentence having been served and all the evidence to support those kinds of claims may simply be unavailable? I mean, is this really a statement about the standard of review that we're supposed to bring to these kinds of records, that it's kind of almost a hands-off sort of something like, for instance, the standard that applies when somebody wants a mandate recalled? So what's your thoughts on that?
Yes, Your Honor, I do think it's a standard of review issue, but I think it also depends. I think one of the reasons that the Supreme Court said, and it's cited in our briefs, is that it is hard to conceive of a case in which quorum nobis review would be warranted, or getting a writ of quorum nobis would be warranted, simply because leading up to this proceeding, there have been so many opportunities for the appellant to have brought these matters before a tribunal and litigated them. So just because of the opportunities. And secondly, in part because of that, the court has said this is the law on quorum nobis, and it is reserved for only the rarest of cases. And I do think that does go to the standard of review. So it's not just an error of law that the appellant has to show. It has to rise to that extraordinary level. I see that my time is up, Your Honors. Thank you. I would ask this court to affirm the district court's judgment, the 72-page memorandum in order. Thank you.
All right. How much time does counsel have?
About 2 minutes.
Yeah, a little over 2 minutes. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll run through these points really quickly. Counsel's comment about clear error, I think most of our criticisms of the memorandum opinion had to do with what I would call irrelevancies. It doesn't matter if the offer was contained in a particular document. It doesn't matter whether it's customary to have a 5K1.1 motion followed by a Rule 35. And a lot of the findings are basically of that nature. The fact that Carmi testified that he didn't expect a Rule 35 at trial does not support the fact that that he didn't expect one. He lied when he said that, and I think it's pretty clear that he lied when he said that. It certainly contradicts Judge Weber. As far as no new avenue is concerned, the problem here is that I think trial counsel thought that there was a possibility that there might have been something out there about further relief, but when they tried to explore it, they had no evidence. We had no facts to support this kind of stuff. So that was why these things weren't contained in prior proceedings here. This is a very unique case, and it goes to some of the discussion at the end of counsel's presentation about the rarity of coram nobis. The facts here are quite unusual, where 8 years after the fact, by a chance occurrence, Mr. Bransky got his hands on a letter from Carmi's counsel that showed that there had been a Rule 35 offer and that Carmi had lied when he denied it. That was in a meeting with Dean Hogue of the AUSA's office here. And using that, this whole avalanche of information came out. This court has basically held that the standards are similar in 2255 and coram nobis cases. Treated them, you know, sometimes if somebody filed one at the wrong time and said, okay, well, we'll just treat it, you know, as the other one. So my time is up, but thank you, and we would urge reversal in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is well argued. It is submitted. Ms. Anderson.